all kinds of different intellectual property rights out there. Some of them are known to the general public. Copyright's fairly well known to people these days. Patent, most people have heard of. People may have heard of design rights. They've certainly heard of trademarks. Lots of people have heard about them. Whether or not people actually understand these things particularly well is another matter altogether. There are all kinds of copyright myths out there. I actually do a lecture based on copyright myths, what people believe and what is actually true. There are also all kinds of intellectual property rights that lots of people haven't heard of. Trade secrets, geographical indications, why you can't call your Yorkshire cheese feta cheese anymore. Semiconductor chip topography rights, which is of interest to my colleagues in computer science, less so to my colleagues in the law school. Plant varieties and performers' rights. All of these are intellectual property rights. What we are going to look at today is, as far as I'm concerned, is going to be primarily copyright, simply for reasons of time. But it's worth bearing in mind that the work that you do may contain more than one intellectual property right. So if you are a researcher in drama and you are recording plays or a ballet or whatever, there may be copyrights. There'll be copyrights in the music, there'll be copyrights in the word, there'll be performers' rights to take into account. A whole range of potential issues there. Copyright. For those of you who have trouble getting to sleep at night, you can download the Consolidated Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. Which I over there is 1988, 324 pages of it. Not riveting, unless you're a lawyer. So we'll do a quick summary. What is covered by copyright? Well, literary, dramatic, musical, and artistic works. Literary works concern academics quite a bit. Literary works can include anything from an academic monograph down to an email. As long as it meets the criteria for copywriting, it can be copyrighted. And so you find, for instance, that in the past, academics wanting to edit the correspondence of authors have discovered that the authors can stop them from doing that by pointing out that they own the copyright in the letters, in the words that were written. So even though they were sent to somebody else, the person who wrote them retains that copyright. One of the problems with copyright is that it started off as something to protect essentially books and writings, and it's now been expanded to cover all kinds of other things as well, including computer programs and databases. There has been a tendency in the law to shove things that don't really fit into copyright in there on the principle, well, we already have international agreements like the Berne Convention, we already have negotiations taking place at places like the World Intellectual Property Organization, so let's bung this in here as well. And unfortunately, some of these things don't fit very well. Computer programs in particular are covered by copyright, which causes the judiciary all kinds of problems when they're given a page of source code and they're asked to say whether or not this is a literary work or not. And also with computer programs, of course, you can do the same thing in two different computer languages so that they look the same on screen. Is that actually copying? Is that a breach of copyright? And there's been long debates about that. What do we need to know about UK copyright? It protects the expressions of ideas and not ideas themselves, your outputs, not the thinking that you've done. It requires that work be original. The test for originality is quite low, but the work must be original. So that cute little picture of the sad-faced clown on the chocolate box is an original work, even if it's not particularly artistic. Geoffrey Archer's novels are original works. So it has to be original, has to be in permanent form. You get some interesting issues around permanent form. If you, as an academic, go out and interview somebody, if you just write down notes as you're going along, you're not taking down what they say verbatim, you will own the copyright in those notes. If you copy it down verbatim, there is likely to be a joint copyright there, because you have written down that person's expression of their idea in permanent form. Ditto if you record an interview. You own the copyright in your questions, the interviewee owns the copyright in their responses, technically. So these are the kind of things that people doing fieldwork have to take into account. You need consents, you need permissions. Copyright does not require formal registration. So you don't have to have a little C in a circle anywhere on your copyrighted works. I get this one a lot with people using things off the internet. People download things off the internet and they want to use them in the research, and you say, well, do you have permission to do that? Oh, it's on the internet, it's free. Didn't have a little circle with a C in it. Doesn't matter. If the work is an expression of an idea, it's original, it's created in permanent form, you have a copyright in that the moment you create it. There is no need to register it, although there are companies that will quite happily register your copyright, but it's not required. So all kinds of things out there, and lots, certainly the majority of things on the internet, are copyright of somebody. Duration of copyright. Copyright, when it started out, was of a much shorter duration than it is today. For literary works these days, it is the author's life plus 70 years. It went up about 20 years ago. There was a lot of lobbying. There still is very enthusiastic lobbying from rights holders, notably the movie industries and the music industries and publishers, for longer terms of copyright. Because, of course, the longer something remains in copyright, the more control the publishers, those rights holders, have the fact that they can continue to sell it to you. Once something falls out of copyright, once it is in the public domain, it can be used without charge. So if you look at the Gutenberg Project online, they publish books that are out of copyright. You have to be aware that the duration of copyright varies according to what it is that you're dealing with. So literary works, author's life plus 70 years, there are different rules for anonymous works, there are different rules for works that have never formally been published, there are different rules for sound recordings, it's 50 years from the end of the year created. Cliff Richard, you may recall if you watch these things in the news, was very exercised by the fact that some of his early work is about to fall out of copyright. And he only has one set of tennis courts at his Italian villa, and he quite liked to put in another one. And therefore, he was one of those lobbying the European Commission for an extension in the term of copyright on sound recordings and broadcasts. Databases, the nominal protection, copyright protection afforded to databases under the database right is 15 years. But if you make a substantial change to the database, lawyers love words like substantial. Because we can argue for years over what is and what is not a substantial change. But it means that things like, for instance, the LexisNexis legal database will probably not fall out of protection anytime soon. Ownership is quite an interesting thing in universities. The general rule in copyright is the original owner of copyright in any particular work is the person who creates it. So you write that best-selling novel, you own, at the point you write it, the copyright in it. However, if you are writing something in the course of your employment, if you are creating a copyright work in the course of your employment, your employer, the default rule is your employer owns that. You may negotiate a separate agreement with your employer, but that's the rule. And of course, lawyers love like the phrase, in the course of employment. What is in the course of my employment? And there have been court cases over lecture notes. Was a lecturer hired to write lecture notes, or was he hired to deliver the lecture? And in that case, which took place back in the 1950s, the court said, well, his lecture notes were his own work. They weren't required, they weren't part of his job. The university didn't require him to write lecture notes. They required him to turn up and deliver the lecture. So one of the things you increasingly find in your own terms of employment these days is something that says the university deems you to be employed for these purposes and things created in the course of those purposes. Because, of course, now we all have PowerPoints, and quite often PowerPoints end up in the VLE or the managed learning environment. They end up in the distance learning pack. And the university is keen to ensure that it has the rights to do that. So again, variations on a theme of who owns. Bear in mind, as we've already mentioned, you can have more than one copyright in a particular work. So a song, the words can be copyrighted, they're a literary work. The music can be copyrighted as a musical work. The sheet music, the layout of the notes on the paper, the typographical arrangement can be copyrighted, 25-year copyright in typographical arrangements. And all of these copyrights can be held by different people. One of the fun things when you're trying to put together sort of databases of things like songs, or you're trying to gather in works, harvesting web pages is another interesting example, is finding out who actually owns these things. What copyrights are there? How long do they last for? Who owns them? Okay, so let's say you've written your future best-selling novel, and you've got the manuscript in front of you. You own the copyright in it. So what? What can you do with it? Well, you have, under copyright law, the exclusive rights to do certain things with your copyright work, making a copy being the obvious one. Public performance of your work, broadcasting your work. All of these things are what we would term the bundle of rights that you are granted by copyright. And you can do all kinds of things with this bundle of rights. You can sell them in whole or in part to somebody else. One of the things academics are and have been prone to do in the past is you write a monograph and you think, ooh, I'm going to get published, and you get the publishing contract, and academics, even legal academics, don't always read their contracts in a great deal of detail. And one of the things you will find somewhere in the contract is that you assign your rights in the work to the publisher. It used to be quite common with journal articles. You assign rights to the publisher. That means you are giving those exclusive rights that you have to somebody else. And you lose those rights because you've now passed them on. You've sold them. And we used to have major problems with journal articles because people would publish something in a journal and say, oh, well, this would be quite useful to show to my students. And you'd say, can I put it on the virtual learning environment? And you'd have to say, well, no, you can't, because we don't have the right to put it on the virtual learning environment. And the academic would stamp and huff and say, well, it's my piece of work. And you say, well, you wrote it, absolutely. But you've sold the right to do the thing that you now want to do to somebody else. So you now have to go to the publisher and ask their permission. The particular example I was thinking about involved, I think it was Elsevier back a few years ago now, and somebody had written a journal article, and they got it published by Elsevier, they signed away their rights, they went back to Elsevier and said, can I put this on the thing? And Elsevier said, of course you can, that'll be £2,000, please. So you might not want to assign your copyright, you might want to license it. You can say, I will allow you to do certain things that are my exclusive right on certain conditions. So you might license your manuscript to the publisher. The publisher will probably want an exclusive license, i.e. they're the only people who can exercise those rights. But you retain the copyright. And there's a whole raft of issues around assignment and licensing. When you die, your rights can be inherited, well, are inherited by your heirs and assigns, if you've kept your copyright. This is what makes tracing copyright such a joy, is because you find that the original author's died and the rights have been inherited by somebody else, and you've got to find out who they are. If somebody does with your manuscript, let's say, what you've got the exclusive right to do under copyright law, they're breaching your copyright. unless the law explicitly says that they can do it without your permission. Fair dealing and library privileges are examples of that. And licensing is pretty common. People will license permission to do certain things with their works. As we've already just mentioned, you can do certain things without a rights holder's permission. Fair dealing is something that lots of people have heard of, but quite a lot of people don't understand fully. You can fair deal in copyright works for non-commercial research, which is interesting from a university perspective, because some of what we do is commercial and some of it isn't. And it can be quite difficult to tell where the border falls. For your private study, and for criticism and review. But these are very narrow exceptions. The law interprets them very, very tightly. One of the big problems I have with academics is academics go onto the internet and research copyright, and they look at American copyright law. And American copyright law has much wider exemptions, has different exemptions for parodies, for instance. And the academic then says, well, I can do this because copyright law says so. Well, you've got to get the jurisdiction right. You've got to get the law right. So fair dealing, pretty much misunderstood. Creative Commons licenses. These are another thing that's out there now. Creative Commons license, when you use something under a Creative Commons license, you have to bear in mind it is a copyright license. If copyright did not exist, Creative Commons licenses would not exist. And I bring this up mainly because I've dealt with projects, educational projects before, where I've said to them, what is your copyright strategy? And they've said, we don't have to have a copyright strategy because we're using Creative Commons licenses. To which my response is, if you don't have a copyright strategy, you can't effectively use Creative Commons licenses because you need to understand what rights you own in the works before you can license something under a Creative Commons license. If you are not the rights holder of a work, you cannot license it under a Creative Commons license because you don't have the rights that you are purporting to license to other people. Not going to talk very much about Creative Commons because I've got about 3 minutes left. So, if you want to let other people use your copyright work, you can assign the rights, you can sell the rights in total, or you can sell some of the rights in total. You can use an ad hoc license. You can say, okay, you can have these rights in return for these particular benefits. You can, if you are an author, grant a collective licensing agency the right to deal on your behalf. You can allow people to use things under a Creative Commons license. You might put a photograph that you've taken on the web and your Creative Commons license says, all you have to do is attribute this to me to make sure that my name stays on the photograph. Or you can dedicate the work to the public domain. You can say, I am essentially renouncing my copyright now. There is a question under UK law as to whether or not you can actually technically extinguish a copyright like that. But essentially what you're saying to people and what the defence that they would have were this to be challenged would be that we've made this available to the public. If somebody breaches copyright, it's not a criminal offence in most circumstances. There are certain criminal provisions, but it's generally a civil issue. In other words, that the person whose copyright you breached can get an injunction to stop you doing it. They can get damages for any losses you've caused them. They can also, if you are, for instance, mass producing their CDs, they can have your equipment confiscated. Intellectual property cases are extremely expensive to take to court. If you go to court, not only have you had a solicitor's firm involved, but you will have a barrister as well, and barristers charge even more than I do a day. We ideally want to stay out of court. One little tip there. First rule of litigation, this is what they teach. The first thing they teach you at law school is don't sue poor people. Unless your client wants to prove a point, and all the people at the moment who would be getting sued for sharing files online are very much in that category, and the client wants to. Universities are not perceived as poor. Universities are perceived as deep-pocket litigants, though, people who can afford to pay out. So people will sue you if you misuse other people's copyright. Rounding up. If we're creating research data, one of the things we need to decide first of all is whether our research data is capable of being copyrighted. Bear in mind the test, this idea that it has to be original, it has to be fixed. Raw research data, raw outputs from, I don't know, science experiments, astronomy, are probably not copyrightable. They may be protected by other intellectual property rights, but they're probably not copyrightable. The next question is, if it can be copyrighted, who owns the copyright? Do you as the researcher own the copyright? Does your institution own the copyright? If you've been doing, as we were saying, interviews, is it a joint copyright between you and someone else? Or have you got them to assign those rights and so on? If other parties do have rights in those data, what can you do with them? And if the answer to that question is, well, I know other people have rights in these things, but I can't find an exemption in the Act, and I haven't got a license or an assignment, the answer, broadly speaking, is that you can't use them. So one of the things that we tend to do when we're looking at projects, is particularly projects where we are going to be using third-party data, is we say, right, what licenses or what assignments do we have to ensure that these people sign so that we can use our data in our research project and potentially afterwards? Because you have to be thinking beyond the life of the project. And this has been a big problem in academia, is people tend to be very, oh, it's a three-year project. Right, we'll get the stuff all together, all the licenses for the project, and then you say, well, A, we'd like to archive it, B, some other people would like to use it, C, we've got funding for a further project, but we can't use the data anymore. Or we have to go back and renegotiate all the licenses all over again. So if you've licensed rights in, have you got all the rights you need to carry out all the research you're intending to do to disseminate those results? And if you want to, or if you're required to, by your funding body, to archive the research data and indeed give other people access to it. It's not a lot of point of having it archived if you can't access it for the author's life plus 70 years. So what I tend to say to projects, all projects, is as part of your legal risk assessment, and people always go, oh God, legal risk, as part of your legal risk assessment, which will take into account things like copyright, if you're dealing with individuals, human subjects, it may involve data protection. Almost certainly these days will require an assessment of whether or not parts of your research data you wish to keep confidential for various reasons, for freedom of information purposes. So you do your risk assessment, and we look at the kind of things we've just talked about. Who owns the rights? What's our IPR strategy going to be? What's our relationship with third parties going to be? Do we want to be careful not to grant too many rights to publishers or not grant too many rights to sponsors, industrial partners? Where are those rights going to fall? And in multi-party projects, you want prior agreements on IPRs. You want to know exactly where the rights are going to fall, because you do not want to get to the end of an expensive research project and not have that sorted out, because that's where the arguments start and that's where the lawyers turn up. So you want prior agreements on who owns the stuff, what the conditions are for sharing the research data, and whether or not you as a researcher can continue to reuse that data after the end of the project. The other thing that I find academic projects in the past have not been terrifically good at doing is documenting those agreements. So it'll be done on a verbal basis, or it's done on a handshake. And as we lawyers like to say, verbal agreements are with paper that they're written on. Usually I advise projects to have what I would term a rights register. It can be a database on your computer, it can be an A4 file folder with copies of the agreements, the terms, exactly what was said. So that if there's any disagreement, you can turn to your rights register and say, this is what was initially agreed. You'll also find that archivists love you if you've produced this kind of stuff, because it then tells them what they can use or what access they can grant in the future. And ideally these days, when a lot of the data we collect is digital, you can attach this kind of information as metadata. And legal metadata is quite an interesting area, quite a growing area, is how do we actually apply all this stuff? Now, do I have time to just... I've actually got many, many case studies, probably more than I should have. It tells you something about the state of the way in which higher education still handles IPRs. Nice example here. A few years ago, I was parachuted in, as tends to happen, to a project called Chameleon. I forget what Chameleon stood for now, but it was all about something that the BBC had produced in 1986 in commemoration of the Doomsday Book in 1066. And what the BBC had decided to do was to have this big project where they would go out and collect a record of what it was like to live in the UK in 1986. And so they had newspaper cuttings, they had video, they had materials from school children, they had photographs from a competition they ran, they had photographs they bought from commercial firms, and so on and so forth. And the BBC thought it would be a tremendous idea to put this on the technology of the time, which was laser discs. Now, I'm sure you all today have laser discs in your front. Laser discs was around for a flash in time, because very rapidly CDs and CD-ROMs and then DVDs came along. And so this project, which the BBC intended to be out there for school children and researchers to use as a resource for the longest time, basically by the year 2000, you couldn't find it anymore. The University of Leeds had a video disc player, and the disc, the Royal Ontario Museum, of all places, had one. You've got one somewhere. But people either had the disc and they didn't have the player, or the thing was buried somewhere and it wasn't being used. And so the Chameleon Project said, right, what we want to do is to essentially pull the information off the video disc and make it available in a more modern technology. Unfortunately, they discovered that in order to do this was originally written, I think, for the Apple Acorn, they had to emulate the software. And the first question was, who do we get permission from to emulate the software? And it turned out that Acorn Apple, or whatever, had gone bust, and the intellectual property had gone on to somebody else, and they told it to somebody else. And we couldn't actually determine who owned the rights in the end. And it turned out that the BBC had either not bothered to collect any copyright information or had lost it. So we have a video disc contain all kinds of copyrighted works that are sorted by software in which there is a copyright, and we have no evidence to say whose rights are involved at all. Now, fortunately for the project's point of view, the Leeds University Library, which was running the project, could take advantage of the archiving exception in the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, which allows libraries to make archive copies of works that are otherwise going to be falling apart or unavailable. I mean, it was originally designed for books that fell apart, but it applies even as well to the technology. So they could emulate for those purposes, they could copy for those purposes. But the next question was, then can we make it available more widely? Can we commercialise it? And the answer to that was probably not, or not easily. There have been a couple of attempts since this project to go down that route, and to the best of my knowledge, all of them have tripped on the hurdle that there are so many copyright works in this video disc for which authors, creators, rights holders may come out of the woodwork at any time and say, oh, you've used my work and I've suffered damage as a result. And the next thing you know, you've got an injunction stopping you selling your disc and you're being sued for damages. Biomed Image Archive at Bristol University. It was a digitization project. The university, the people at the university, project at the university, had a raft of biomedical images that they'd acquired from all over the place. These collections were sort of accreted at the university, as they tend to. And the Biomed Image Project said, fine, we've got all these fantastic biomedical images. I know, we'll stick them all on the web so that people can access them. It's a public resource. And they held their first seminar, at which our data protection officer was present, and our data protection officer went ballistic. And shortly thereafter, the university took itself to take a little bit more interest in what was actually going on, and I ended up sitting on the committee looking at whether or not we could actually put these images on the web. And there were questions, first of all, of data protection and confidentiality, because some of these things involved pictures of people with pretty nasty medical conditions. It was the case of tertiary syphilis that remains in my mind the longest. But there was also all the questions of intellectual property rights. Who owns these photographs? And more often than not, the biomedical image archive had no idea. Or it turned out that the rights in these things were owned by people who hadn't given permission, the National Health Service, for instance. And so we ended up drafting a protocol for the project. And for each photograph, 15 of the 15,000 that they had to go through the protocol and say, right, do we have the copyright? Does this show an identifiable individual? And so on and so on and so on. And it cut the image archive down to 7,000 images, because there are at least 8,000 that we couldn't use for one reason, or the copyright being one of the major reasons. I seem to remember we sold the biomedical image archive to another university. Haven't seen it appear anywhere yet. So clearly they're probably still dealing with those kinds of problems. But these, again, are issues with research data in terms of actually being able to use it at the end of the day. And I will stop there.
There are very other examples, but thanks very much, Andrew, for that. I know it was tough to condense copyright into a few slides.